Thank you. Be seated. Well, first of all, I'm Judge Allen, and I want to thank Cornell Law School for the tremendous welcome that we've had and the great discussions I've had with so many of the veteran students here and veteran supporter students here. I also want to thank you because between the tour of the law school that we were given earlier today and the walk down the aisle here, I've gotten more exercise than I usually get in a long time, so thank you very much. I do also want to say that the third member of the panel is Judge Falvey, our colleague, who at the last minute was not able to travel to hear argument. However, he is going to continue to serve on the panel, and after submission of the case today, he'll be involved in consideration and decision of the case, and he does express his thanks to Cornell for the invitation, and sorry he could not be here. We're here this afternoon to consider arguments in the matter of Roger W. Weicker versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 215454. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record?
Thank you, Your Honor. Amy Odom from Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick, and with me at counsel table is David Giza.
Thank you. Secretary?
Mark Hamill for the Secretary, and with me is Deputy Chief Counsel James Kelly.
Nice to see you again, Mr. Hamill. Ms. Odom, are you going to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, we'd like to reserve 10 minutes, please.
All right, we've done that. You can begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Judge Allen, and may it please the court. When VA first notified the veteran in October 1965 that it had denied his claim for service connection for cataracts, it failed to provide him with any notice about his right to appeal that decision or the timelines for doing so. It therefore failed to provide him with full notice of the decision, which included not only the reasons for the decision, but also the right to appeal and the time limits for doing so. As a result, the decision denying service connection for cataracts never became final and has been pending since 1964. This is consistent with and, in fact, required by the Federal Circuit's holding in AG. If there is no notice of appellate rights, the decision doesn't become final.
So, what do we do with the fact that there was a letter in January, which, other than saying that cataracts were denied or granted when they were actually denied, checked off all the other boxes, right?
No, it did not, because it told him that he had only a year from the date of that letter to appeal. That's not true. Had they provided full notice of the denial of cataracts, he would have had a year from the date of that notice.
Yes, and fair enough. I mean, I will tell you, just so the Secretary's on notice, right, the board's determination that the January letter complied with the notice requirements is, I mean, to be frank, the most clearly erroneous finding I have ever seen. Right? So, I'm with you on that. But what I mean is, in the January letter, there was a notice of some decision, right? There was a provision of the fact that it could be appealed, right? So what I'm getting at is, the board analyzed this as a matter of prejudicial error, right? What do we do with the fact that later that year, VA has its whoops moment, right? And finds out, wow, we told the guy we granted when we actually denied. And then they send him this letter in October that doesn't have appellate rights. Mm-hmm. But the one in January did. So how do we, can we put them together?
No. First of all, the regulations at the time, 19.109, required that the notice of appellate rights be included with notification of each determination of non-entitlement. And so, or with the notice of each determination of non-entitlement. So the notice telling him for the first time that they had actually denied cataract, by regulation, also had to include the right to appeal and the time limit.
And so what do we do with the very strange thing? I agree with you, and that's the way I had read this, and I focused as well as you did on the word each. And then a very diligent law clerk said, you know, there's this other rule that says, well, we're supposed to give you notice of appellate rights, but if we don't, you don't get any more time to appeal. Rule 10. What do we do with Rule 10?
Well, what's important about Rule 10, and it says that the time for taking appeal cannot be extended, but the time for taking an appeal does not begin to run until the veteran gets, or the claimant gets, full notice of the decision, which by regulation required the notice of appellate rights and the timeline for taking the appeal. So the only way to read 19.110 as consistent with the mandatory language in 19.109 and 3.103 and not rendering the superfluous that mandatory language is that it's simply saying that once VA does provide the appellate rights, which it's required to under its own regulations, then the time for appealing cannot automatically be extended just because they didn't provide the notice of appellate rights in the first place. It's the only way to read it to be consistent with the other regulations and also consistent with foundational principles of due process and the right to procedural right to notice. Also, when VA finally did get rid of that rule in, I believe, 1983, it itself acknowledged that the language in the rule created some ambiguity, and it was their established practice to have a self-imposed duty to provide notice of appellate rights in each notification of a denial. So 19.110 just doesn't change the analysis here.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
It did. I mean, I'm with you that it's a very strange thing to have one rule that says we must provide notice and the next one says, but if we don't, well, you get the time you would have had we given notice in the first place. It's really, it's an odd rule to wrestle with. I agree with you.
And significantly, neither the board nor the secretary invoked it here in this case.
Are you familiar with a recent case from our court called Cowan?
Yes.
So, well, you may also be aware that I don't agree with what I'm going to say now because I effectively dissented in the case. That case stands for the proposition that you can read, with respect to a notice requirement, a different notice requirement. You can satisfy the notice requirement by looking at two different places, right? In that case, it was a letter and a decision. Does Cowan have any implication for how we should consider whether or not the October letter can be read in conjunction with the January letter to put them together? And neither one is sufficient, but you put them together and the sum is greater than the parts?
No, because in Cowan, the letter and the decision are provided to the veteran the claimant at the same time. In fact, the letter is part of the notice requirements, or the requirements that are in the letter are part of the statutory requirement for notification of the decision. And here, it's not like VA provided the decision that said denial and then in the letter said, you have 1 year from the date of this letter to if you don't agree with our decision. They didn't tell the veteran about the decision until 9 months later. And VA can't. What's to stop VA then from providing notice of a decision and saying, just so you know, going forward, if we deny any claims in the future, you have 1 year from the date of that denial to file an appeal. But most importantly, under the facts of this case, the January 1965 notice was misleading because it told him he only had a year from the date of the January 1965 letter to appeal a claim, which is not true because the VA didn't provide notice of the denial until October 1965, and had they provided full notice, he would have had a year from October 1965 to file the appeal.
Say again how you reconciled 19.110 with 19.109?
Sure. So the very
you may be right on the process issue, but how do you reconcile the two?
The very last sentence of 19.110 refers to the time period for filing a notice of disagreement. But the statute at the time said that the time period did not begin to run until VA provided notice of the decision. And the statute didn't define notice except to say that it must be written. Instead, VA filled that gap with 3.103 and 19.109. 3.103 in particular defined notice of a decision as containing three elements. First, the reasons for the decision. Second, the right to appeal. And third, the time limit for appealing. What this all means is if you had a stopwatch and you clicked go when the time for appealing began, you wouldn't click it until the veteran got all notice of all three of those elements. And so when the 19.110 is referring to the time period for filing an appeal, it's talking about the time period after notice, once notice comes in, which includes the time limits for appealing. So the only way to read that, to not render the mandatory language of 3.103 and 19.109 superfluous, is that you don't get an extra 6 months. You don't get 18 months just because we took 6 months to tell you your appellate rights. You get 1 year from the date of appellate rights. It's the only way to read it that's consistent with the rest of the statute, the regulatory scheme.
But how can it be that you read it from notice when the operative clause begins failure to notify?
Notify of appellate rights, but notice includes appellate rights. So they're saying the only way to read it as being consistent with the rest of the regulatory scheme is that if the notice is inadequate for some reason, you don't get
on the decision itself. That's what you're saying on the notice of the decision itself, not the appellate rights and the time to appeal.
Yeah, I misspoke when I said for some reason. If the notice is inadequate because they didn't provide the appellate rights, you don't get an automatic extension of that 1 year period. To read it otherwise would put this court in a position where it would have to strike it down as inconsistent with the rest of the regulatory scheme.
Can a regulation be inconsistent with a regulation?
Yes. Well, in this case, if it's read to say that you still only have a year after you get appellate rights, it would be inconsistent with the mandatory language in 3.103 and 19.109. VA will provide notice. It would also butt up against foundational principles of due process, as I mentioned. I mean, even as early as Mullane in 1950, an individual had the right to notice that a matter remained pending and a reasonable opportunity to assert any objections. Here, the October 1965 letter told him it was over. It didn't tell him that he had any more opportunity to object to the decision, and therefore it wouldn't even pass muster under the Fifth Amendment.
But you didn't argue that there was a constitutional due process here in the briefing, did you?
We didn't, because there's a regulatory violation and AG controls. AG says when there's no appellate rights, the decision doesn't become final. Although the statute at the time of AG also required notice of appellate rights, it's the same outcome as you get in Berard versus McDonald, where the Federal Circuit held when VA receives new evidence within a year and doesn't carry out its regulatory duty to determine whether it's new material under 3.156B, the legacy version, the decision doesn't become final. The bottom line is, when VA has a regulatory duty to do something, even putting the Constitution aside, and it doesn't do that, the decision does not become final.
Let's assume that there's a problem with notice somehow. January, October, some problem. What's your understanding of the board's prejudicial error analysis, right? Because, well, first of all, you agree that we have to make sure that the error was prejudicial, right?
I do.
Right, because that's what the Supreme Court said generically, that there are no bright-line, automatic, hard rules.
Right, but if there's no notice, if there's no adequate notice because of the appellate rights problem here, then the prejudice is clear on its face. The claim remained pending, and the board should have granted an earlier effective date.
Let's assume I'm with you on that. As I read the board's decision, what it said was the January letter is okay. But even if we assume it isn't, it didn't use those words, but even if we assume it isn't, the October letter, in conjunction with the veterans' attempt to appeal the January decision the month before, the NOD, potential NOD, shows that the error was harmless, either because he had actual knowledge that he could appeal a decision, or because a reasonable person would have been on notice that they could appeal. I just want to get your reaction to the board's use of that analytical framework to judge prejudicial error.
Sure. So Judge Falvey, as he noted in his memorandum decision, held that actual notice would be a defense to the lack of notice argument here. But the board never found that the veteran had actual notice of the time limits, which again is a crucial part of the three elements of notice, of the time limits for appeal, because he filed an appeal a month before, or attempted to file an appeal to a non-appealable decision a month before VA provided him with notice of the denial of cataracts. That is not evidence of actual knowledge that he would have had until October 1966 to file an appeal to the notice, to the decision denying cataracts.
So the board took the framework of actual knowledge and reasonable person. It sort of took that from the Sanders case at the Federal Circuit. But that case was reversed. It was overturned by the Supreme Court in Shinseki versus Sanders. So what is the appellant's position about whether that analytical framework using those actual knowledge, reasonable person, survived the Supreme Court's reversal of the Federal Circuit?
Well, as to Sanders specifically, that had to do with the pre-decisional VCAA notice. And as I recall the Supreme Court's decision in Sanders, it had to do more with the natural effect of prejudice and whether there was a presumption of prejudice. But our position is that this whole reasonable person standard just doesn't apply to the notice requirements under 3.103. There's actual knowledge or there's not. But even if this court were to create a new rule that reasonable notice test does apply to appellate rights, here the board actually did not find that the veteran had reasonable notice of the time limits to appeal. Again, a very important element of notice. It found only that he had actual knowledge. And it's right that they didn't find that he had reasonable knowledge, because no reasonable person would read that January 1965 letter that specifically said you have 1 year from the date of this decision to appeal if you disagree with this decision, to understand that when he got notification that it was of a different decision 9 months later, he would have had a year from that notification to file an appeal.
So if we were to adopt some form of actual knowledge or reasonable person standard for judging prejudicial error, let's just assume that for a second. Is that a question of law, or is that a question of fact, or something else?
It's a question of law, because I disagree that it's a prejudicial error analysis. It's really whether there was adequate notice, right? And whether there...
That's something separate, right? In other words, the board sort of... At different points in the board decision, it's hard to tell which of the parts it's looking at. Let's just pretend we had a super clean analytical structure where the board says, we find, as a matter of fact, that the notice was defective. However, moving on to the next part, we find that that defective notice was not prejudicial to the veteran, because either a reasonable person would have known, given what happened, or because we find there's actual knowledge of the omitted information, right? If we were just looking at that, I just want to get your view about, would we assess that as a question of law, as opposed to whether or not the notice was satisfied in the first place, which is a question of fact?
So let me take this in pieces. I think the adequacy of notice is actually a question of law. What the notice said are questions of fact. So there's facts about what the notice said. Whether it met the legal requirements for notice is a question of law. And whether the notice...
And what case, because I wrestled with that a little bit, right? Because it doesn't always matter, that distinction we're talking about here. If you were going to have to cite me a case that I could refer to about that question, because we've got some loose language, as does the Federal Circuit, loose language in cases that says the adequacy of notice is a question of fact. I tended to go into this agreeing with what you just said, that the actual what the notice said is fact, but whether that complies with the law is at a minimum a question of application of law to fact.
Right.
So do you have a case?
I think I would analogize it to cases that talk about sufficiency of evidence, maybe, like Horn versus Shinseki and those cases that deal with the presumption of soundness. Because like Your Honor just said, it really is a question of whether the facts met the legal standard for notice. So going from that point, whether the notice reasonably informed a veteran of the appellate rights would then be a question of law, not a question of fact, because it goes to the adequacy of the notice. So I think the board got it confused when, to the extent that there is a reasonable person exception to the appellate notice rules, which AG doesn't leave any room for. AG just says if there is no notice that of appellate rights, then it's not final, if I may just finish my thought. To the extent that they talked about the reasonableness as part of a prejudicial error analysis, that was wrong. That goes, if it exists, to the adequacy of the notice. Whether there was actual knowledge is a question of fact. But the board's finding here that filing a notice of disagreement to a completely different decision based on information that the wrong timelines is actual knowledge of the right to appeal a separate decision and the timelines for appealing that decision is just clearly erroneous.
What insight does the record provide regarding what the veteran would have done differently if he'd received clear and correct notice?
Well, in 1973, he attempted to reopen the claim to seek benefits again. And then in 2007, he filed again when he finally did get his benefits. I think his continuing to go back to the VA seeking benefits is evidence that had he known in 1965 that he can continue to pursue the claim, that it was, in fact, actually still pending, he would have continued to pursue it. And just not in the record, in our own discussions with Mr. Weicker, he has indicated to us that he did not understand in 1965 that he could appeal the denial of cataracts. And if he had understood that, he would have attempted to appeal it on his own.
He just filed a claim in 1973, right? Wasn't it for cataracts and glaucoma? He didn't. It was VA that couched it as an attempt to reopen.
That's right. I misspoke.
All right, well, we'll give you your full rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hamill, for the Secretary.
May it please the Court. There is some disagreement as to the type of argument that appellant is pursuing in this appeal. Appellant asserts in his reply brief that he is not merely disagreeing with the board's factual findings. But I would point out that this court did discuss the evidence in this case in the court's October 2020 decision. At that time, appellant asked this court to reverse the board's decision, arguing that the only permissible view of the law is that the evidence in the 1965 decision is not final. And this court rejected that argument. And no new evidence has been submitted since the October 2020 decision. Therefore, it follows that there is a permissible view of the evidence that the 1965 rating decision is final. Although appellant denies he is merely disagreeing with the board's factual findings, that is exactly what he is doing.
And that's, are you making a law of the case argument?
To the extent that appellant continues to argue that there's only one view of the facts, it would really raise two concerns. And the first concern wouldn't be law of the case, I think it would be re judicata, this court has already decided that there is a permissible view of the facts. And secondly, I think it raises the issue of what was the point of remanding to allow the court to allow the board to make factual findings when the whatever factual findings are going to be rejected.
I thought that the reason the court had remanded in the earlier decision, which was a single judge decision, but could have preclusive effect in this case, right, was because the board had insufficiently explained its reasons or bases.
That was one of the reasons, Your Honor. But that same argument was made by counsel in the briefs to the court previously, that there's no permissible view of the evidence that would allow for this decision to be final.
So, but then we have this weird tightrope that the Federal Circuit asks us up here to walk, which is we can't make factual findings, right? But we have to decide whether things are prejudicial error, and we have to make sure that the board sufficiently explains itself. So, of course, in a situation where the board might not have done that, a party might argue to us that there's only one view of the evidence. But we might say, well, we're not even to the point of whether we can do that because, to use a baseball metaphor, you know, the pitcher hasn't even thrown the ball yet, so I can't tell whether it's a ball or a strike, right?
Right, Your Honor. But I would point out in this court's previous 2020 decision, this court went through the facts. The facts that we've been discussing, this court was well aware of the facts. We had this notification letter. We had the correction, the two letters sent by VA. This was all part of this court's prior decision.
So let me ask you this. Under your view, standing here today, when did Mr. Weicker's period to appeal end of the denial of service connection for cataracts?
It was the board found that the notifications were proper from the January 1965 letter, so that would have been 12 months from that date.
So
from the board's finding.
So the board only, if you read the board and you have read the board decision carefully, the board actually only focuses on the January letter in terms of the notification. It discusses the October letter, but only in connection with its prejudicial error analysis. So, first of all, do you agree with that? In other words, did the board independently make a factual determination, assuming it is such, that the October letter, standing alone, was sufficient as notice?
The January one was sufficient as notice, yes.
Right, but so my point is, since we're reviewing what the board did, the board focused its analysis on whether notice was compliant on the January letter standing alone. Yes, it talks about the October letter, but as to say why it determines no prejudice. Are we on the same page there?
Yes.
Okay. And I, you know, you've appeared before me a number of times, Mr. Hamill. But so are you seriously saying that a letter that says disabilities listed below are service connected and then has the word cataracts could in any world be sufficient to inform somebody that in fact the exact opposite is true?
Yes, Your Honor. Because the letter also says the opposite. A few lines down, it says service connection for an eye condition is denied.
So, okay, well, I'll take you on that. So the letter says, so if I said to my child when they were younger, you can have a cookie, you can't have a dessert, would my instruction be clear to my child about whether they could have a cookie or not, right? Because you've just said they're two inconsistent things. So Mr. Weicker should have read from this that the VA said you are service connected for cataracts, you are not service-connected for an eye disability, to understand that I'm not service-connected for cataracts?
Your Honor, this board, the court charged the board to make factual findings, and this court did not charge the board to decide what the veteran understood. What the board was charged to do was to look at this notice regulation and decide whether it was compliant.
Fair enough. You agree in the abstract that in order to be sufficient, notice of a decision has to tell you what the decision is.
Sure, Your Honor.
Right? I mean, right. I was hoping you weren't going to fight on that, right? Okay. This decision says, under your own description that you just gave me, you are service-connected for cataracts. You are not service-connected for an eye condition. And that should tell somebody, leave Mr. Weicker out, that should tell somebody that I'm not, in fact, service-connected for cataracts.
Your Honor, that's not the question. The question is...
Oh, yes, but you see, because it is, because I just told this story last night. What I just said to you was a statement with an inflection at the end, right? So by definition, what I just asked you was a question. So you can explain to me what you were going to explain to me, but answer my question first. When VA sends a letter that says you are service-connected for cataracts, you are not service-connected for an eye condition, the board is correct that that is sufficient to tell somebody they actually aren't service-connected for cataracts.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, because that's not what the board addressed. The board didn't address whether it was sufficient to notify. We're just talking about the regulation, whether there was compliance with the notice regulation. So they're not going any further into trying to discern what was in this veteran's mind.
How could this be possible? It be consistent with when it says you are service-connected for one thing and you're not service-connected for another, when in fact you're never service-connected for anything?
Your Honor, I think that you could draw different conclusions from the evidence here. And in prior, opposing counsel focuses on the fact that it said service connection was granted for cataracts. And we acknowledge that. But the notification letter also said that service connection was denied for an eye condition. So it's contradictory. It's internally inconsistent.
Isn't the most reasonable reading of the notice that the RO granted service connection for cataracts but not for the veteran's other eye conditions is congenital nystagmus and defective vision?
I don't think it would make any sense, Your Honor, to say eye condition to mean certain eye conditions and not cataracts, which is clearly an eye condition.
It's just like the example Judge Allen gave. Cookie is a kind of dessert, but if you specifically grant service connection for a cookie, then the general dessert doesn't include it. It's the eye conditions besides cataracts.
Right.
And he had eye conditions besides cataracts, right? That's in the January 7th rating decision that he never saw.
Correct, Your Honor. It doesn't make sense for the VA to send notification about a general condition, eye condition, and to say it was denied for eye condition, and then to also say it was granted for cataract. So I don't think you can draw a conclusion of anything based on that, except we're not sure what it says. There's a granting, there's a denial. So for that reason, the board can look at this, because it was denying benefits, to say that it complied with the reg. The reg has certain black letter requirements. They were met here. The board made that finding. And beyond that finding, they also said, even if the reg is not complied with.
So let me just ask you this. What if this notice letter in January had said service connection granted for cataracts, denied for eye disabilities, including cataracts? Would it have been compliant with notice then?
I think the board would have found it compliant. That seems to also indicate that there was a denial and there was a notification that complied with the regulation.
Even though it also said the same thing was granted.
Either way, Your Honor, it's contradictory.
And that's what I mean. So contradictory notice is compliant notice?
With the letter of the regulation, yes, Your Honor.
Isn't the first and most obvious requirement for notice to be adequate that it be accurate? So you're saying any notice will do? It could be the sky is purple, even if it's obviously blue.
Your Honor, the regulation has three components. The board looked at the three components, as was the directive of this court, and said those three requirements were met. Now, beyond that, we can discuss whether he understood the requirements or not, but looking strictly at the black letter requirements of the regulation, telling him that a claim was denied, what his appellate rights were, and what his time frame was, the board correctly stated that. So the board was trying to answer this court's question.
But what the board did is what we're reviewing, and we don't have to accept that.
Correct.
So I'm asking you about the correctness of what the board did.
Okay, Your Honor, as far as correctness goes, this is a factual finding, and the board only needs a plausible basis for its findings. We don't have to find...
What is the plausible basis?
The plausible basis is the fact that that notification letter from January 1965 said that an eye condition was denied for service connection, and the black letter requirements of the reg were satisfied. So there is a plausible basis. If all that letter had said was cataracts granted and nothing else, there would be no plausible basis for the board's finding. But here, because that letter actually said eye condition was denied, there's a plausible basis. And I understand this court is struggling with that, and that's fine.
Well, no, I'm only speaking for myself because I haven't conferred with Judge Jaquith or Judge Falvey. Let's just assume that the court is not struggling with that and that at least one member of the panel finds the board's decision clearly erroneous, even if that standard applies. So the January letter, let's just assume now that the January letter is deficient. I find the more interesting question in the case concerning prejudicial error, the prejudicial error analysis. So can you pivot to that and tell me the government's position about the
board? I can, Your Honor. And I do want to, just for clarity, when it comes, there were two charges by this court. First, the court said for the board to address the notice requirements and the prejudicial error from that, and then second, about the notice of disagreement notice. So as to the first part about the notice, There's really three bases for this court to affirm the board's decision. You could find that the notice requirement was sufficient. You could find that this veteran had actual notice.
But the board discussed that as part of its prejudicial error analysis.
Correct. So Your Honor, if there was error,
okay,
the board said it's not prejudicial because of either the reasonable person standard or the actual notice standard. So there's actually three separate reasons, even if this court doesn't agree with the notice being sufficient, there's two additional reasons that this court could affirm the board's decision. Okay, so as to the reasonable person exception.
Well, so I want to step us back and ask whether the board was correct to assume that the reasonable person and or actual knowledge standards are actually appropriate standards to use in the prejudicial analysis because they come from, and that's why this is, for me, the most interesting part of the case, they come from the Federal Circuit's vacated decision in Sanders. The Supreme Court vacated it. And the Federal Circuit discussed those as saying, in a context in which the Federal Circuit said we are going to presume something is prejudicial, unless the secretary shows these things, right? So it's an entirely different framework. So this is the first time the court has really been able to return to this issue since Sanders from the Supreme Court to say, how should these issues apply in the context of prejudicial error? So for me, it's an open question about whether or not the reasonable person standard in particular is appropriate to judge in this context.
Your Honor, the first thing I would note is that this court specifically told the board to address whether appellant had actual notice of all three elements under 3.101, and that's from the record at 206. So to the extent that the board got there, it was following this court's mandate. And it's the Secretary's position that those exceptions do apply because we still have a rule of prejudicial error. We can't just look at whether there was defective notice. If this particular veteran had actual notice, of his appellate rights.
So how should we, why should we assume that notice of rights to appeal a determination that cataracts have been granted, we're assuming that now because you only assume that if you're moving on to prejudicial analysis, okay? So have been granted but at a non-compensable level. Why should we assume that that also shows knowledge of the right to appeal a total denial? You and I know that for certain, right? Because we're in the system and we deal with this. And maybe everybody else in this room who's associated with the law school knows that. But why would a layperson be said to have actual knowledge that because I'm told I can appeal this one type of decision, I've granted but given you zero, also lets me appeal a decision that says I've denied?
The board found that appellant had actual knowledge based on three things, Your Honor. First, there was a September 1966 form for educational benefits that indicated he did not have a VA claim pending.
So, by the way, right, okay, so I don't understand why the board, and you defend in this case, the board's reliance on things that happened after 1965 to show he had actual knowledge in 1965, right? So if I were 22 years old and somebody said, well, you knew how to be a parent, look at what you did with your son in 2010. Well, the mere fact that I know how to be a parent in 2010 doesn't tell me anything about when I what I knew 10 years before. So the mere fact that this veteran knew how to do things about other claims after the fact, why does that show he had actual knowledge of the ability to appeal earlier?
By itself, Your Honor, it's not too probative. But the board just didn't rely on that. The board also said there was a later letter regarding educational benefits that stated that cataracts were not service-connected. And then getting back to the time frame you're talking about, there was a September 1965 letter, which is talking about, relates to more current knowledge, from the attorney indicating that appellant had consulted him in a timely manner about the appeal.
Yes, but that's the point. You see, so here, I agree with you, right? If we're reviewing what the board does, we have to look at what it does. I'm telling you, the board mentioned some things after 1965, and it doesn't explain why something that happens after 1965 shows knowledge in 1965, right? And then it does point to the September letter. That's in the relevant time period, but that gets to my first question. At that point in time, he had been told, you have been granted service connection, but at zero, and you can appeal. Why should we assume that he would understand that the decision that says you are denied and doesn't say anything about appeal rights, why should we assume that he has actual knowledge that he can appeal that?
Your Honor, partly because it shows that he understood what happened with his claim, that he didn't have an appeal pending.
I don't follow that, which is me.
We're talking about the September 1965 attorney letter.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it reflects that he understood the situation. That's the opposite of what the board says the situation was. How does that show actual knowledge that imputes notice to him?
I think because, like Judge Allen was previously saying, how can you expect a young person right out of the service to know what he's supposed to do? This particular veteran, back in 1965, knew what to do. He consulted with an attorney, and the attorney filed a notice of disagreement.
Right. He understood it perfectly. He understood that the board that granted him service connection for cataracts, denied him a compensable rating, and denied him service connection for eye conditions and a conversion reaction. But that's not what the board found. So how does his understanding that comports with a reasonable reading of the January 11th, 1965 notice letter get argued as actual knowledge of something completely different?
It's the attorney letter, Your Honor, that he consulted with an attorney, that he had the wherewithal to consult with an attorney and act inconsistent with what the notice regulation.
So we get just back to Judge Allen's question. So your argument is that the fact that he consulted with an attorney in September of 1965, filed an appeal in accordance with a reasonable understanding of the notice letter, means that he also knew that the next month he would get a completely different decision, no rights notice, nothing, but he would know, that a reasonable person would know that he had still only 3 months left to appeal.
Your Honor, this court has case law about drawing inferences from a lack of action, that someone with knowledge would have either filed a claim or complained about something. The board is doing nothing different here. The board is saying it was clear in 1965 he understood how to exercise his appellate rights. He didn't exercise his appellate rights once he found out what the true nature of the rating decision was. And they're just drawing an inference from those.
He didn't get any appellate rights.
Yes, and why in the world should we assume that if he was told, I've got service connection, but at 0%, I'm going to appeal that, but being told I'm denied service connection, oh, okay, I'm okay with that, I won't appeal that. That doesn't make that. If the board drew that inference, the board is as clearly wrong to me as its determination that the January letter is good. You're in a difficult position, in my view, Mr. Hamill, right? It's difficult to defend this.
Your Honor, what makes it not difficult is we're not trying to interpret the facts and coming to a right result. What we're trying to do is say, here's what the board found. Is there a plausible basis for the board's decision? And even if this court would come to a different decision, even if this court would interpret the lack of action over the years in a different way, the real question is there a plausible basis for the board's decision in this case? And the board was just doing what this court instructed it to do. And here, if you look at what the board relied on, the fact that he consulted with an attorney and didn't take any further action, that provides a plausible basis. That's not an abuse of discretion. And again, I would point, you know, this pretty much came up before this court back in 2020 with appellant arguing there's no other view you could take from the facts, and this court said, here you go, board, we want you to make determinations here. And this court did not say, okay, we're looking at these facts and there's no other conclusion that we could come to.
Well, but that's because, I'm not sure here it makes a difference about the earlier remand, right? The board simply said, or the court, as I read that decision, says the board didn't explore these issues, right? So I'm not faulting the board for example, talking about actual knowledge, right? Now, we got to decide whether, okay, first of all, is that really a standard that should apply? But even assuming it is the board's discussion of that clearly wrong, right? So let's just assume with me that we find that the 1965 claim remained open and that the error was prejudicial. Just assume with me for that for a minute. On my little scorecard, that brings us to the 1973 claim, right? Because what impact, if any, does that have on the 1965, or it's actually a 64 claim, if we assume that remained pending and we have what happened in 1973 happen in 1973?
The claim could have been cut off in 1973, but I don't think that was really addressed in the briefing in this case, Your Honor.
Well, so the board talks about the 1973 issue.
The board did, yes, Your Honor.
It doesn't talk, you are correct, the board does not talk about it, about whether it could have closed out a pending claim, right? So arguably that's a basis to remand, but the board says something weird about that, because even if the 1965 claim was closed, 64 claim was closed, there could still be an issue in 73, in theory, right? That would,
yes,
would be, okay? The board says that the 1973 issue is that the claim was abandoned because appellant didn't submit additional information that was requested. The board says that was requested. I have a lot of trouble reading the letter as actually requesting anything. It was declarative. It told him why it said it wasn't going to reopen the claim, but it didn't tell him to do anything.
I'm really not prepared to address that, Your Honor. I'd have to go back into the record and look. Since that was not really an issue that was briefed in this case, I'm not sure how to respond to that.
Okay, fair enough.
Obviously, this court has some concerns about the factual findings made by the board in this case. And this court doesn't have to like them. It's just a question of whether there's a plausible basis for the board's factual finding. And the board... One other thing I'd point out, when it comes to talking about whether this veteran had actual knowledge, which is something that the board was instructed to address, we don't have any statement in the record. The only thing that the board could look at is the letter from the attorney, the action he took later. So the board has to draw inferences from things like that in a case like this, because that's all the evidence there was. If there was a statement denying that he had actual knowledge, the board could have addressed that. Here, all we have is this documentary evidence, which was before the court before. The board addressed it, and the board relied on this evidence, which provides a plausible basis for the board's factual findings. And if there's no further questions, I'm going to ask that this court affirm.
How does the notice that Mr. Weicker received in 1965 fulfill the due process requirement that the court just 3 weeks ago described in Costello, that entitlement to disability benefits is a property interest protected by the due process clause, and deprivation of it must be preceded by notice and opportunity to be heard, and adequate notice requires accuracy so the veteran can make an informed choice of whether to fault, acquiesce, or contest VA's action?
I think, Your Honor, that raises legitimate concerns about the adequacy of the notice given here. But again, the question for the board was whether there was compliance with the notice regulation, and even if there wasn't, whether this veteran had actual knowledge. So even if this court appears inclined to find that there was not sufficient notice given, there was still a plausible basis for the board's factual findings that this veteran had actual knowledge. So I would say in response, there may be concerns about due process, about the notice in this case, but the board also relied on actual knowledge and a reasonable person's knowledge. And I, before I forget, since this court did instruct me to address 19.110, I just want to briefly address that before I sit down.
Absolutely. And you can have a couple of extra minutes because we gave Ms. Odom.
Okay, I don't think I'll need it. I just wanted to briefly address it. The 1964 regulation stated, while it's contemplated that the agency of original jurisdiction will give proper notice of the right to appeal on such time limit, failure to notify the claimant of his right to such appellate review or a time limit applicable to a notice of disagreement or substantive appeal will not extend the applicable period for taking this action. I would note that this regulation is consistent with the board's decision on appeal, but the board did not rely on this regulation. Therefore, we would also not rely on this regulation.
Could you tell me what you understand that to mean? And it's okay if the answer is, I have no idea.
Your Honor, there's, I think, 8 cases from this court that cite to that regulation, and none of them delve into the meaning of the regulation. I think you can just look at it on its face. It's no longer in effect. There may be some due process concerns. I believe it was in 1980 that, regulation was no longer in effect.
But at least then, for purposes of this case, the Secretary would not rely on that regulation for any purpose.
It would be a post hoc rationalization. The board didn't rely on it. I think, if anything, the court would have to remand for the board to address it, since the board didn't get a chance to address that regulation.
Okay.
And if there's no further questions, we'd ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond. Ms. Odom?
Thank you, Your Honor. I must confess I'm a little confused about why we're now debating whether VA told the veteran in January 1965 that it had denied service connection for cataracts. We don't debate that he did eventually receive notice of the reason of the decision. That was in October 1965. The RO's letter to the veteran itself said, this is your notice that we have denied service connection for cataracts. The issue here is whether that was sufficient notice that made that decision appealable so that the time began to run when it didn't include the notice of appellate rights, including the time limits for appealing. And no, there is no reasonable man exception to the rule in AG that if there is no appellate rights, there's no, the decision doesn't become final. It doesn't become an appealable decision.
Now, technically, though, the AG decision, even though we're bound by the decision, it technically doesn't bind this issue, right? Because the statute that the Federal Circuit was considering in AG wasn't in place in 65, right?
That's true, but AG also specifically cited 3.103 and said it didn't, that the VA did not comply with the regulation then, and relied on cases from this court about when VA doesn't comply with the regulation, then the decision doesn't become final.
Could I just, before you, and then I'll get out of your way for rebuttal, but before you sit down, can you just give me your basic response to this, what I'm going to call res judicata slash law of the case slash mandate rule, something, some version of that, which is not critical to Mr. Hamill, sort of different doctrines that get to the same point about the 2020 memoranda decision? He seems to suggest, as I understand the argument, that because the court remanded and implicitly rejected the argument that you, Mr. Weicker, had advanced, that there was only one permissible view of the evidence, that that somehow has some continuing effect on us in this case today.
No. The court remanded for the board specifically to discuss whether 3.103 had been complied with. The board did not, or the court did not reject the argument that it hadn't been complied with. It remanded for further findings on that matter. Another way that I disagree with my colleague is his assertion that the 1973 letter wasn't a briefed issue. It was. We briefed it fully at 27 to 28 of our brief. We took the position you did, Judge Allen, that the board was wrong to the extent that it found that that letter requested any information. It told Mr. Weicker in no uncertain terms that it would not take any further action on his claim. And therefore, because 3.158 requires as a preface that there be a request for information, the board's finding that the claim had been abandoned when he didn't respond was incorrect.
I doubt we would ever get to this issue in this case, but I'm just curious. So is there a situation in which the denial of a claim to reopen, right, so you deny reopening, can that close out a pending claim on the merits?
Yes, I think that's what this court held in Morris versus Peake. But in that case, there was no dispute. The board made the finding that there was a decision denying the claim. The board correctly didn't find here that the 1973 letter was a decision. And there was no dispute in Morris that the veteran had received notice of the decision. And again, notice includes the appellate rights, the right to appeal, and the time limits.
And of course, there was no appellate rights in the 1973 letter, right?
We addressed that in 27 through 28 of our brief, that it therefore couldn't have extinguished the claim under Williams. And I wanted to touch briefly on Judge Ellen, Your Honor's discussion of Sanders. I refreshed my memory, and the Supreme Court's decision in Sanders actually took pains to make clear that it wasn't reversing this court on its conclusion that what they call error notice one, which was the pre-decisional, so again, there's a major distinction here, the pre-decisional notice of the evidence to submit to support a claim, had there was a natural effect of prejudice arising from that type of error. The Supreme Court took great pains to say that it was not reversing this court's determination on that matter because courts can make, quote, empirically based generalizations about what kind of errors are likely to be harmful as a factual matter. And I would say that this court should adopt the position that incorrect or confusing notice, for example, telling a veteran a claim that had been denied had actually been granted, as a factual matter, is likely to be harmful.
Well, you know, so on that point, so Justice Breyer wrote Sanders, right? And he said, you know, that if any court is in the position to make generalizations, it's us, because we see far more cases than the Supreme Court, certainly, and also than the Federal Circuit. And that led to the empirical language, which Justice Breyer was big in,
right,
too. But what I was having trouble with, I'd just like your reaction, is, so the idea was we see so many cases that we can say this type of error is naturally going to be prejudicial, the natural effects. Mm-hmm. In the 6 years I've been a judge, I have never seen a case in which VA says, you are service-connected when, in fact, you are not service-connected. So I'm not sure what an empirical-based, you know, knowledge would be. I would hope we wouldn't have that level of knowledge, because that would mean there'd be so many cases where VA grants service connection but says you don't have it, or vice versa. You see what I mean?
Yes, but certainly this court has seen its fair share of cases in which the VA provided accidentally misleading notice, for example, in Smith, also in Noah, or inadequate notice. And to the extent that this court has seen cases where the VA failed to comply with its regulatory notice requirements, it has always found that that has rendered the decision non-final. So the court should find here, to the extent that it wants to follow the Sanders analysis, and that there is a prejudicial error even analysis to be done here, it should hold that there is a natural effect of prejudice when the VA provides inadequate or misleading notice, or fails to provide the veteran a notice of the right to appellate rights. And therefore, we would ask this court to reverse the board's decision denying an earlier effective date for left eye blindness, and order the secretary to assign an effective date of June 1964, the day after discharge, because there is no reasonable dispute that the veteran had cataracts at the time that he filed his claim.
Thank you very much. So we want to, again, thank Cornell Law School for having us here for this argument, and we want to thank the parties for traveling to gorgeous Ithaca, New York. And with that, the case is submitted.